The young sergeant, who practiced English with Sarah during their hours of riding, prepared dinner over the modern German equivalent of a Coleman stove. Rourke learned from Sarah that the young sergeant, Konrad Heinz, harbored aspirations of rising to the officer's corps. From Rourke's earlier conversations with Mann, Rourke remembered that a command of English was one of the basic requirements. Rourke supposed it was somehow flattering that the German high command assumed English would still be viable and necessary. Konrad Heinz took the first shift at guard duty, along with two of the other non-coms. Four besides Heinz accompanied the group. John Rourke, Sarah Rourke, Natalia, Wolfgang Mann, Mann's Hauptsturmführer, Elaine Halverson, and Akira Kurinami sat about the stove in a ragged circle, sharing the meager light in a darkness heavy as velvet. The Hauptsturmführer's name was Hartmann.
I would like to ask, Herr Doctor, and perhaps I am speaking out of turn.
You are free to speak, of course.
Thank you, Herr Standartenführer.
Hartmann turned to face Rourke.
Herr Doctor, as someone viewing this apart, so to speak, how do you then view our chances of success?
Our success or failure depends on too many variables. I'd say the basic probability of reaching Dieter Bern is comfortably high. The exact operation I'll have to perform and what in practice rather than theory must be done with the device I remove. Well, now that's difficult to say. But the overall success of your goals, Mr. Hartmann, seems to rest with how accurately Colonel Mann and the rest of you have gauged the public support for this Dieter Bern. If freeing Bern causes the people of the complex to rise up against the leader, and those military forces loyal to the leader can be neutralized or held at bay, then chances for success seem very good. But some of the ifs are very important, and they can't be ignored.
But you, Herr Doctor, you and Major Chemerovna, you are both veterans of such enterprises. Is that not so?
Perhaps that's why John is reluctant to be more specific, Herr Hartmann. I think the best example I can recall is something Sarah told me.
Hartmann turned from looking at Natalia, who sat at Rourke's left, to Sarah, who sat at Rourke's right.
And what is this, Frau Rourke?
I think Natalia is talking about an operation I was involved with through the resistance. The people who were still fighting the Russians once our country was invaded. Many of the men of the resistance were imprisoned along the eastern coast of the United States. There was a storm, I remember. Their women were in self-imposed exile on one of the offshore islands. A group of us, all of us women, went to the prison, forced our way in and out, and rescued the men just before they were about to be shot. I think what Natalia means is that just looking at the odds from a clinical standpoint isn't necessarily a way to judge things. You do what has to be done for no other reason than necessity, and maybe you can get through on nerve.
Rourke folded his right arm around his wife's shoulders.
In Japan, we have the legends of the samurai. One man would take on vastly superior odds, and he would win.
You have to consider both sides of the coin. This is basically a struggle for freedom. This is nothing new to people of my color. Freedom is hard won. I hope you win yours, Colonel, Captain Hartmann, so that we can win ours. Wouldn't it be wonderful to know that we lived in a world where every man and woman and child was free? Where there were no dictators, no slaves. The old world that died 5 centuries ago. We can't afford to let history repeat itself, can we?
Amen.
It was odd. Rourke felt as though somehow he were cheating on Natalia because Mann's troopers set up a separate tent for Rourke to sleep with his wife. They had not slept together since before the night of the war. They lay beside one another now on rigid, inflatable air mattresses that rose some 8 inches above the ground. Rourke stared at the ceiling of the tent.
John?
Yeah?
However this turns out, I'm glad I'm with you.
I'm happy for it, too.
I think I've come to understand what you did with the children. I'll never like it, but as children, they might never have survived. And if the Eden Project hadn't returned...
I tried to do what I thought was best, Sarah.
Why haven't you and Natalia,
made love?
Mm-hmm.
You're my wife. Before I found you, I figured that if there were any chance you'd still be alive, well, I couldn't. It would have been wrong. And now, well, it'd still be wrong. At least to me it would be.
Do you want me?
Rourke stared upward.
The trouble from the beginning, it's that I love both of you. You said that yourself. I want you. But I'd be less than honest if I didn't say I wanted Natalia too. And I reject the idea of...
We haven't made love for 5 centuries.
Rourke eased closer to her, folding his left arm around her. Her head moved to his chest.
That's crazy to think of. That we were born in the 20th century and it's the 25th century. And, that other thing. It's crazy too, I guess.
In the darkness, he could barely see his wife's face.
Pretend.
Rourke felt Sarah's breath against his chest. Her fingers combed his hair there.
Pretend, well, that none of it... that none of it happened, John. Please.
Rourke drew his wife's face up to his, then bent over her as she rolled back. Pretending. It was something he'd never been able to do, even as a child. He lost himself sometimes with characters in books, but he never pretended. He did now. Rourke pretended that the night of the war hadn't happened. He kissed Sarah's lips, his right hand moving beneath the blanket covering her. For John Thomas Rourke, it was no longer pretending. No longer pretending at all. Had it not been for the arrival of the fighter planes from the underground city, which he summoned just after sending word to Krakowski to break off any engagement with the wild tribes of Europe, Vladimir Karamazov realized all would have been lost against the Nazis. But with the arrival of the planes, certain defeat became a glorious, if costly, victory. 8 of his helicopters were destroyed. 3 more needed serious repair, and work crews, even at this late hour, he checked his watch, it was nearly 2 a.m. here, labored over them. 63 men and women were killed or seriously wounded. One of the jet fighters had slight damage and was under repair. The Nazi force had not only been beaten back, but took what Karamazov estimated as over 28% casualties and lost 9 machines totally. Their casualty figures could have been higher. 12 of the peculiar yet efficient-seeming mini-tanks were destroyed as well. But at the height of his despair of the losses suffered, Karamazov received an encrypted radio message from Nikolai Antonovich. Antonovich found the Nazi headquarters in a rain-forested area of Argentina. Vladimir Karamazov walked the length and breadth of his camp. His plans were firm now. Soon, Krakowski's elements would be arriving. But he would not wait for Krakowski and his helicopter squadrons and troops. He recalled the jet fighters from pursuit of the retreating Nazis. He ordered Major Antonovich to secure a landing site where troops could be debarked, where helicopters and jets could be refueled. He would take the Nazi stronghold in Argentina. He would utterly destroy it. After that victory, he would return to Georgia and the Eden Project. Karamazov stopped near one of the prefabricated hangars and watched as a work crew restored one of the damaged helicopters. They worked with great efficiency. He took pride in their work. Vladimir Karamazov studied his watch again for a moment. The work crews would not complete the repairs until dawn, and shortly after dawn there would be the perfunctory burial services for his fallen troops. And then, Vladimir Karamazov had just tasted victory. He longed for that taste again.
Herr Skorn!
Yes, Helmut.
Where?
Helmut Sturm watched the eyes of Sturmbannführer Axel Kleist, ignoring the fact that he was speaking to a superior officer. He was tired, dirty, discouraged, and faced hours of writing letters to the families of his dead.
Standartenführer Mann!
Sturmbannführer Kleist seemed to slightly regain his composure.
He has been forced to return to the new fatherland.
Helmut Sturm stared down at his muddy boots. They sat down in a swamp in what had once been Louisiana in order to tend to some of the wounded.
Why, Herr Sturmbannführer?
That is not the concern of a junior officer. Or need I remind you, Hauptsturmführer Sturm?
Helmutsturm stared beyond his boots at the encampment from which a dozen of the machines and a full company of men were missing. Two dozen more of the machines were preparing for departure.
What an entire legion, Axel!
Helmut! The Standartenfuhrer knows what he is about!
The Soviets cannot be attacking the complex. Not yet, at least. Nor can these Americans.
He waved dismissively in the direction of their camp several miles to the south.
Not in the antiquated spaceships. There's only one reason why the Standartenfuhrer would authorize such a large number of men to return to the new fatherland.
Do not say this, Helmut.
Kleist's blue eyes narrowed, his shoulders hard set in his short frame. The man was almost a miniature and barely the height requirement for an officer. Helmut Sturm towered over his superior.
Do not say treason, Axel. Do not say that he goes to somehow attempt to effect the rescue of Dieter Bern before the execution which is scheduled for Unity Day. Do not say this. If you tell me it is not true, I will not.
The Standartenfuhrer has the best interest of the German people at heart.
Wolfgang Mann has never been a Nazi, and neither have you. You have never shared the dream, and neither has he. Is it not so, Axel?
You overstep your bounds! You shall be shot! I could have you shot!
And I, Axel, I could have you both shot. And I will.
Helmut!
He shouted to his Obersturmfuhrer, who stood some 100 yards away, gaping open-mouthed.
I have relieved the Sturmführer of command. Take what men you can who are loyal and assault the departing gunships. Be quick, man!
His pistol still cocked, Helmut Sturm ran toward the airfield at the far end of the camp. The gunships were already beginning to take to the air, and he fired toward the nearest of them, the range hopeless, and the effectiveness of his bullets doubtful at best against the armored bodies of the great machines. He emptied the pistol, then stood staring skyward, hearing the rattle of small arms fire around him, his right arm hanging limply at his side. He had been betrayed. The new fatherland had been betrayed. The leader. Helmut Sturm would gather what remained of his forces, what loyal men and officers could be gathered up from this encampment. And before following the traitorous Standartenfuhrer Mann to the complex, he would destroy these American spaceships and the men and women with them. Destroy. It was all he could consider now.
Michel Privel!
Helena Sturm sat at the dinner table, leaving the chair at its head vacant, as she did always when her husband was away with his troops. At the opposite end, since he was the oldest man in the house, despite the fact that he was a boy, sat her son Manfred. Helena Sturm looked at his very pretty face.
Why do you stare at me, Manfred?
I have become distressed, Mother.
You worry concerning your father, then. But I am sure...
My father and the troops of the new fatherland shall be invincible, Mother. I am distressed at what I have come to learn.
Helena Sturm dropped the spoon with which she had been stirring her coffee.
I do not...
But you do, Mother. You understand quite well, I am afraid.
A boy should not talk thus to his mother, Manfred. I will tell your father.
I doubt you will tell my father any of this, for I have followed you, Mother. And I have curiosity concerning the topic of which you speak so secretly with the wife of the Standartenfuhrer Mann.
Eva Mann? But she and I are friends, Manfred.
You are not of her station, Mother. There is something besides friendship of which you speak.
Helena Sturm set down the spoon, which she had picked up. It made the shaking of her hand that much more visible.
I don't understand, Manfred.
I want more cereal, Mother.
Yes, I'll get it.
Willy, you will wait for your cereal.
Helena Sturm looked across the table at Manfred.
Don't talk to your brother like that. And don't talk to me like that either.
Then I shall talk to the supervisor of the youth, Mother. I shall tell him what I suspect.
Helena Sturm stood up. That her hands trembled mattered no more to her. She felt the child, or perhaps there were two, as her doctor suspected, but she looked at her son.
You will obey me as you would obey your father. What I do is none of your concern, Manfred. When your father returns, if you feel that my conduct must be reported, then tell him. You are my son. You are in my charge, and you are responsible to me, and to your brothers, and to your father. We are your family, not the youth. I am your parent, not the supervisor of the youth. Is that clear to you, Manfred?
My primary obligation, Mother, is to the party.
Manfred, you should not speak this way to Mother.
Yes, you are being bad, Manfred.
Now Willie stood, apparently his quest for cereal abandoned or forgotten. She could not help but smile as he spoke.
If you talk bad to Mama, I'll punch you in the nose, Manfred.
Hush, Willie. He is your older brother, and you should respect him.
Willie looked confused. She didn't blame him. Manfred stood.
I leave now to meet with the supervisor of the youth. Your reluctance that I speak with him only confirms my worst suspicions, Mother.
You will not leave this house.
It is an apartment, Mother. The concept of the private house is an anachronism. You live in the past. You refuse to prepare for the glories that is our future.
Manfred!
He threw down his napkin, stood very erect, and straightened his youth scarf about his neck.
I am leaving now, Mother. And in your present physical condition, I should not advise that you attempt to interfere. I, like all members of the youth, revere women who fulfill their biological destiny by providing those who will serve the new fatherland in the years to come. But my duty is my first concern, Mother.
He turned as though doing an about-face, then walked from the room.
Mother?
She looked at Hugo.
Yes, darling. Berthold and I, we could try to stop Manfred, Mother. No, he is your brother.
Mama, can I have more cereal now?
She leaned forward and kissed Willie's forehead. She realized that she was holding Hugo's shoulders tight.
Berthold, fix your little brother some cereal. I must use the telephone.
She walked around the table and toward the small hallway by the door, just as she saw the door close. Manfred was gone. Helena Sturm's hands still trembled. She picked up the telephone.
Eva, I'm sorry to trouble you. This is Helena Sturm. Manfred, I fear.
John Rourke swung down from the virtually pommelless, cantle-less, English-style saddle to the rocky ground beside the already dismounted Wolfgang Mann.
We are here, Herr Doctor.
John Rourke looked over the terrain before them. A massive valley, lush with rich green vegetation, sprawled before them. Gray, rocky abutments rose from amid the green. A river coursed through its center. It could well have been paradise, or, given their mission, the gateway to hell. Rourke had the uncomfortable feeling he was about to find out which. Natalia swung down from her mount, as did Sarah.
Where is the entrance? From your diagram, I was looking for a peculiar triangular-shaped rock.
But it cannot be seen from here. We must walk along a very narrow trail. The horses cannot come. I should have drawn the map more carefully. I apologize, Fraulein Major Tiamarovna.
Elaine Halverson turned from gazing at the valley aboard her mount.
Are we coming in through the tunnels with you?
John has something else in mind, I think.
We discussed this a little last night. Because of your obvious non-Germanic appearances, neither of you can enter the complex. And Akira already knows his part. Sergeant Hines will accompany Colonel Mann, Sarah, Natalia, and me. Elaine, you and Akira will travel with the four remaining enlisted personnel. Captain Hartman has other duties.
Rourke looked up at the four enlisted men. They were still mounted.
You'll position yourself strategically outside the main entrance of the complex, either to be backup force or coordinate efforts with the remainder of Colonel Mann's forces when they arrive. From what the Colonel tells us, the tunnels are too narrow in spots and far too treacherous to bring a large body of fighters with field equipment through.
Rourke began untying gear from his saddle. His pack was already on his back, because with the English saddle there was no place else to tie it. He removed the pack now. He left the CAR-15 in his truck, taking instead two M16 rifles for the heavier volume of fire they could lay down. Natalia and Sarah were each similarly armed, and there were several 800-round containers of 5.56mm ball that would accompany them. He slung the M16's crossbody, one on each side, adjusting the position of his musette bag at his left side where it became entangled with a rifle.
Something goes wrong, you and Akira are going to have to kind of wing it.
He secured the canteen, one of the round, blanket-covered, Western-style canteens, on his right side, on its strap, opposite the musette bag. He picked up the pack and began securing it into the actual seat of the saddle, the only way it could be secured. Halverson and Koranami would take the horses with them. Rourke glanced to Natalia, then to Sarah. Both of them were doing roughly the same with their gear. He looked to Sergeant Hines. Hines alone bore a pack and also two of the Nazi assault rifles. Their rifles were apparently based on the successful G3, but used a caseless cartridge, similar to those used in the new 40-round capacity Soviet assault rifles. But the magazines were not plastic disposables, and the caliber seemed closer to 30 than 20. From what little he knew of both rifles, he favored the German. Their pistols, Mann alone carried one, were apparently not an issue item for a non-com, and not the P-38 Mann wore before. Their pistols seemed derivative of the Walther P-5, but with double-column magazine enhanced capacity. The bore diameter was smaller than 9mm. The caseless pistol round more resembled a .30 Mauser. Hines had one of the 800-round boxes of 5.56mm ball at his feet. Rourke walked to one of the still-mounted non-coms, taking down from the man the second box. Rourke found himself smiling, wondering if the exalted Standartenfuhrer would take turns on the 800-round box his non-com carried. He made a private bet with himself that Mann would.
I'm ready.
Natalia settled her purse, converted into a backpack mode, across her shoulders. She picked up first one, then a second M16, cross-slinging them over her shoulders, as Rourke had done. Sarah stood beside Sergeant Hines. Rourke extended his hand to Elaine Halverson and then to Koranami.
Good luck.
Rourke waited now beside the lip of the rocky outcropping overlooking the valley, Sarah and Natalia flanking him.
We are ready, Herr Doctor.
Mann took the ammo box from his sergeant and started ahead in a long-strided march. Rourke followed after Mann, smiling. He had won the bet. Annie thought of her father's words, "Be prepared." She was. When she left the retreat, she packed three useful objects. One was a dark gray skirt that reached to her ankles. On the surface, she realized a skirt did not seem terribly useful. Even so, she packed it with her few other clothes. The other two objects she packed in a Ziploc bag and were secreted under the seat of her father's camouflage pickup truck. Both trucks were stripped of weapons, ammo, and gear in the aftermath of her father and mother freeing Natalia. But the hollow under the pickup seat was never checked. She waited until dark and went to it, feeling in darkness under the seat amid the springs and finding the bag. She sat now on the edge of one of the two cots in the smaller tent, beside the tent shared by Michael and Paul during their recuperation. Madison sat opposite her.
You have a look in your eyes, Annie.
Madison smiled, buttoning her blouse, then sitting on the edge of the opposite cot and putting on her shoes. Annie hitched up her slip and began pulling on the over-the-knee woolen stockings. They were black, and they were warm, and the previous night had been cold. When she wrapped herself in a blanket to go to the showers that morning, she nearly froze. The weather had again changed, and drastically. She half expected snow from the gray of the clouds. Annie stood up, her slip falling below her knees.
What look in my eyes?
A look that says, I have a secret, is what I mean.
Annie picked up the long gray skirt, then started stepping into it, buttoning it at her waist. She found a black turtleneck sweater and pulled it on, straightening the turtleneck and freeing her hair. She bent over beside her cot and pulled out the combat boots. Her father planned ahead with that. He bought several pairs of combat boots in her mother's shoe size and several additional pairs in sizes smaller and larger. It worked out, and although she liked to credit her father with exceptional foresight, she realized it was a lucky gamble. Madison's feet fit the smaller boots. Annie's feet fit the larger ones.
What do you have in your boot?
Annie placed the two objects she retrieved from the truck on the cot, then raised her left leg, hitching her skirt up above her left knee.
This is a Bianchi leg holster. Daddy used it when he was in the CIA a few times. I took a tuck in each of the elastic bands, and it fits just perfectly now.
She secured the two elastic straps, one above and one below her calf, over the heavy stocking on the inside of her leg. She raised a wooden and gleaming steel object.
And this is an American Derringer Corporation 45 ACP Derringer. Same caliber as my Detonic Scoremaster. The Derringer goes in here.
She settled the Derringer in the leg holster, then lowered her foot from the cot and let her skirt drop.
See? Don't see it, do you?
A gun? On your leg?
American ingenuity, kid.
She sat down on the edge of the cot and started getting into her combat boots and thought about the Eden Project personnel files. All the time Annie spent working with the master computer aboard Eden 1 turned up dossiers that all seemed perfect, and hence none of them were outstanding enough to seem spurious. Hugging her coat about her and the shawl about her coat, Annie entered Michael's and Paul's tent, Madison behind her.
You could at least knock, Annie, for God's sake.
Michael was sitting up.
I can tell you're feeling better.
Annie went to her brother, kissed his cheek, and smiled. Then she turned, walked to the opposite side of the tent, and kissed Paul.
And how are you today?
Dr. Munchen came by. Says I can walk if I take it easy. Gave me another zap of that spray. God, does it itch. You look like you're ready for winter.
You stick your head outside this tent, Paul, and then you'll see why I look like I'm ready for winter. And that's exactly what you're going to do. You can walk, but you have to take it easy. And you can walk over to Eden 1 with me. Plenty of nice, soft rocks along the way you can sit on to rest. And then you can help me fool with that damned computer. I was working on it till midnight last night. Everybody's perfect. We gotta figure out some different questions to ask the machine.
The secret of life.
We already know that. Now, do I help you get dressed, Paul, or do Madison and I wait outside?
I can dress myself, but I don't think I've been right yet.
Yes, I'll get your boots.
She grabbed Madison by the hand and propelled the younger woman through the tent flap ahead of her. At Annie's request, Captain Dodd started putting a guard at the hatchway of Eden 1. She felt certain that if there was something in the computer that could help find the murderer, then the murderer might try disabling the computer. Paul Rubenstein's body tensed against her as they neared the entrance to Eden 1. The man on guard was Forrest Blackburn. Blackburn was the man who hit Paul over the head with the wrench, whom Annie subsequently shot in the thigh. Dodd still had his no-guns policy in effect, and Annie personally thought that was rather stupid, particularly here, where a man stood guard at a sensitive site with no weapon to back up his words. But Captain Dodd didn't ask her advice.
That son of a bitch.
Hey, when you're all well, I'll call him a... what you called him. And then when he goes to punch me out, you can punch him out instead and look all gallant and everything. But right now, you're in no shape for a fight.
He's still a son of a bitch.
They were nearly within casual earshot of Forrest Blackburn. Annie brushed back her wind-tossed hair and smiled at Blackburn.
How are you, Mr. Blackburn?
Miss Rourke, Mr. Rubenstein. Leg stiff when I walk, but no big deal.
Paul stopped walking. He couldn't tell if he was tired or was planning something.
Blackburn, once I'm back in shape, you and I got something to settle.
I'm sorry you feel that way, Mr. Rubenstein. It wasn't anything personal the other night.
Bullshit.
Paul started ahead. Annie clung to his arm. Blackburn stepped in front of them at the base of the stairway leading up into Eden 1.
Look, I understand Captain Dodd is allowing you to use the onboard computer, Miss Rourke, but there's nothing in my orders about allowing Mr. Rubenstein aboard. I'm afraid he'll have to stay here.
Look, you can waste everybody's time by making me hunt up Captain Dodd, or you can let both of us in right now. There's a killer loose around here, regardless of what you and some of the others might think. And if we don't find him or her, then when Karamazov and his people come back, every one of us is going to have to spend more time looking behind us than ahead of us. Now, do I get Dodd to pull your plug, or do you let us both inside?
She was gambling that Blackburn was trying to provoke Paul, and at the same time just trying to be obstinate. She waited. She could have straight-armed him in the Adam's apple. Her father taught her how. But that would only further provoke things and cause relationships between the Rourke family. She lumped Paul, Natalia, and Madison, even Kuranami and Halverson under this classification mentally, and the Eden Project people to further deteriorate. After a long moment, Blackburn stepped aside. He smiled.
I used to be pretty good with computers myself, Miss Rourke, and I have some training on this one in particular. I could help. I can guard this thing just as well from the inside as the outside. I'm sorry. I was only trying to do my job the other night, and now.
Forrest Blackburn stuck out his right hand. Her eyes flickered to Paul. She watched something that looked like a momentary flash of disgust pass across his eyes, and then he took Blackburn's hand.
I'm freezing out here, guys.
Both of you, go ahead, please.
Blackburn even reached out to help Paul start up the steps. Paul sat before the computer, rubbed his eyes, and smiled.
I'm not really an old man, I just feel like one.
Annie kissed his forehead, her hands lingering against his face and neck. She turned around to look at Forrest Blackburn.
Now, just what are you trying to find out? Maybe I can help. Like I said, I'm pretty good with computers.
Annie looked at Paul. Paul nodded.
We're trying to find whoever has the most perfect dossier of any of the personnel aboard Eden 1 or Eden 2. So far, everybody looks perfect, just from scanning their files.
Do I look perfect, too?
Yes, but no more perfect than anyone else.
So, your theory is that if you find the one with the most spotless background, it's obviously the Russian agent you believe is among us.
That's right. So if you believe we're wrong and Natalia is the killer, then the best way to prove your point is to help us.
Annie looked at Paul. He was smiling.
Well, I think I can ask the computer to sort through the personnel data files itself and then determine from those, maybe in ways more subtle and logical than we could, who the killer is. Who's the most perfect?
He started across the cabin to the seat Annie would normally have taken, then sat down.
I mean, if you guys don't think I'm interfering.
Blackburn looked first up at her and then across to Paul.
That can't hurt.
Fine, try it.
3 hours passed. Annie wondered just how long Blackburn's tour of guard duty was supposed to be. Blackburn was reprogramming the cataloging of the personnel files, and it seemed to be taking too long a time. She sat perched on the armrest of Paul's chair, just about to make some mention of the time factor.
What the hell?
She glanced at Blackburn. Blackburn was up, racing to the fuselage door, Annie behind him. Annie looked skyward, over Forrest Blackburn's massive shoulders. He was a tall man, darkly good-looking and well-muscled, it seemed.
Nazis!
Get back!
Annie drew back inside the meager protection of Eden 1. The shuttlecrafts did not seem to be the objects of the attack, but a half-dozen helicopters and some men on foot were attacking, it seemed, the main portion of the camp.
What the hell's going on?
It must be the rest of the Nazis! With Colonel Mann gone, they must have found out why he's gone and they're attacking!
Oh, gotta get out there.
Annie started toward Paul to try to keep him from getting up.
I ought to thank those guys.
Annie turned to Blackburn. In his right hand, he held a pistol. It was Paul's battered Browning high power.
What the...
Shut up, Rubenstein. The two of you stay nice and still. No sense wasting energy with this computer. I can give you the information you need.
You?
See, I don't know if the computer would show me up as the most perfect background or not. But it might show that I knew Mona Stankiewicz, and did it show that I went to college in West Germany. So you two clods might put two and two together and figure that while I was in West Germany, I got involved with the East Germans, which I did. And that I got involved with the KGB, which I did. But this... this is just perfect. With what I did to the computer's personnel files these last couple of hours, nobody will be able to really figure out anything. And if they do, it'll be too late. See, confusion is always the best ally. Your gun, for example, Rubenstein. It's a 9mm Parabellum. Some of the Germans I noticed, some of the officers, they carry 9mm. Maybe sentimental about the good old days 500 years ago, huh? When they were killing Jews.
You mother...
Shut up, Rubenstein. Initially, Dodd and the others will figure you and Miss Rourke were killed by the Germans. By the time anyone finds your bodies out there dead from fighting beside them, I'll be long gone to the other end of the camp.
To report to that bastard Karamazov.
No, not really. I didn't kill Mona for that, just to keep my identity from being discovered. She was going to turn me in. She didn't care she'd get herself in hot water. I guess you could count this as wartime, so that means I could have been shot. Nah, I'm not running at Colonel Karamazov.
Why did you frame Natalia? It can't hurt to tell us.
No special thing against her. She never met me. But I had to kill Mona, and Major Chimarovna was the logical person since she was a KGB major and everybody knew it. The hatred was already there. It was easy for me to whip people up into a mob without them even knowing I was the one who'd done it. But I don't owe any allegiance to the Colonel. Karamazov was willing to shoot me down with the rest of the Eden Project. I got other plans.
What?
Well, Captain Dodd. He dies during the attack here, see? And I become the leader. the leader of the Eden Project for openers. My plans are flexible. Who knows after that? Now both of you get outside.
Fuck you!
Blackburn reached out and grabbed her, dragging her against him. Annie hammered at him with her fists, but the muzzle of Paul's gun was raised toward her face.
It's easier for me if you die outside. And look at it this way. We all go outside. Maybe I'll stop a stray bullet. Or you can jump me, Rubenstein.
Annie watched Paul lunge slowly from his chair as Blackburn shifted the muzzle of the pistol away from her face. Annie stumbled, falling backward toward the door. Paul and Forrest Blackburn grappled over the pistol. Annie reached under her clothes for the Derringer, drew it, forced her thumb down against the spring pressure of the hammer to get the pistol cocked. Blackburn raised his right arm. He slammed the Browning down against Paul's head. Paul fell back. Annie stabbed the Derringer forward, but Blackburn's right foot snapped up as he wheeled toward her. The pistol flew from her hand. Blackburn jumped for her as Annie threw herself across the cockpit floor for the pistol. He landed on top of her and twisted at her left arm. But she was reaching for the Derringer pistol. For the last 20 minutes, by the luminous black-faced Rolex Submariner on Rourke's left wrist, the group had progressed in single file through a tunnel roughly the height and width of a sewer pipe. But the space was uneven, bending, and at some times partially blocked by mounds of dirt and rocks. There was no light. Rourke thought of films he saw over the years or watched by means of his VCR. In the darkest tunnels and labyrinths, somehow there was always a light source. It was never totally dark. Here it would have been, except for the synth-fuel-powered lanterns Rourke, Sarah, and Natalia carried. Colonel Mann and Sergeant Hines carried two spares, as yet unlit.
This way.
Rourke led the way, Mann behind him, directing their course each time they came to a portion of the tunnel that segmented. Rourke attempted all the while to memorize the rights and lefts they took, just in case they needed the tunnel for their escape, and Mann was not available to guide them. With his Gerber, he scratched arrows into the tunnel walls to mark the path. He placed the arrows to be intentionally misleading, marking the wrong passage rather than the correct one. Where there were more than two choices, he would mark the correct passage instead. He hoped the result would be thoroughly confusing if anyone attempted to follow.
Whew.
At times, the air was close and foul-smelling, and at times it seemed as though there would be no air at all, and the lanterns themselves would flicker. But when the lights of the lanterns would steady, their breathing, too, would ease, and they would pick up the pace. Rourke checked his watch. He noted that the overall time so far spent in the warren of tunnels, caverns, and cut shafts was 3 hours. He stepped out of the tunnel and into less confining space. A massive cavern opened before them. He called a halt. He was on a tongue of rock that extended over a yawning precipice, the cavern ceiling perhaps 100 feet overhead. At the base of the drop, perhaps 100 feet below, a silver ribbon of stream gleamed dully as Sergeant Hines flicked the search lamp from the cavern ceiling downward.
We'll rest here.
Sarah walked past him toward the edge of the spit of rock, shining her lantern into the void. Because the mantle surrounding the synth fuel flame was a lens rather than plain glass, the light was intensified and illuminated enough of the void to see that indeed nothing was there.
It's beautiful, but creepy.
Natalia sat down beside Rourke on a rise in the rocks. She leaned her head against his shoulder for an instant, and Rourke smiled at her. Natalia sensed he and Sarah made love the previous night. Rourke was glad she knew it. That morning, she had kissed his cheek and proclaimed her happiness for them.
How much longer, Colonel?
I think, Fräulein Major, that another 2 hours remain before us. From here, we must travel downward, along a steep path that would be better traveled by goats. I have read of goats. They sound marvelously interesting.
I used to eat goat every once in a while.
We had this older gentleman who used to stop by the house and sell us hindquarters of goat. I finally got to where I'd barbecue it, and we'd eat the goat ribs like regular ribs. And
you ate goat?
Yeah, tastes pretty good, too. Little gamey.
Gamey? I do not know the word.
That means there is a certain wild taste to it, not like something that is bred to be eaten. Deer is a good example.
Ah, the hind, yes.
Rourke thought of a line from Shakespeare that particularly amused him.
If a hart doth lack a hind, let him seek out Rosalind.
He looked at Mann's uncomprehending expression.
I always thought it was an interesting double entendre. Don't mind me.
Shall we get started again, my friends?
Why not?
Rourke stood, taking up his lantern and his 800-round box of 223.
It is better, I think, that I take the lantern and lead the way.
Rourke handed him the lantern.
Herr Doctor, perhaps you should be last.
Agreed.
Mann started ahead, back along the outcropping of rock that formed a peninsula in the airspace, and down, his lantern, a beacon Rourke could follow along the corridor of darkness. Rourke followed after Natalia, Sarah behind Sergeant Hines. The lantern Natalia carried illuminated the rocky downward path sufficiently that Rourke could see to walk. Beyond the shaft of diffused yellowed light, Rourke could hear the sounds of tiny rock falls. They would begin, but it seemed as though they would never end. On a rational basis, he knew they had to. He also heard the gradual building of rushing water cascading over the rocks in the underground riverbed below. He imagined that in the time prior to the fires that consumed the sky, the caverns likely teemed with bats. But like all other wildlife, they would be gone. They walked on. It was necessary now, at times, because of the narrowness of the ledge, to move sideways, scraping the back against the rock surface, arms and hands and fingers splayed along it for the added fractional inch of purchase, inching ahead rather than really walking at all. They traveled for what seemed to Rourke like an hour, but when he checked the face of his Rolex, it was only half that time. And suddenly, the ledge widened and gave way to an apron of rock that bit deeper into the rock face. By stooping over, it was possible to get further back from the edge. After several more minutes, the rock surface widened still more. Rourke could see Wolfgang Mann's lantern swinging back and forth. Rourke almost knocked Natalia down, bumping into her as Mann brought their file to a halt. Rourke followed the light, then, as Mann drew back further still from the edge into what seemed like a shallow cave mouth, the shape roughly like a shell. He watched the light, how it seemed to linger for an instant in the darkness, and then disintegrate.
We rest here, hmm?
Right.
All three lanterns set down, the five people forming a ragged circle around them.
We shall be soon turning. Not so much downward as we have been moving, but along a pathway which is at times horizontal and at times, from our perspective, diagonally ranging upward. It is very narrow, but there is a further complication once we enter onto this path. I discovered it as a boy, but fortunately in such a manner that I myself was not discovered. The rocks, they form a natural whispering gallery here. The effect is at its greatest at the height of the path, and then decreases after several hundred yards to where it will no longer be a concern. But while we travel through the whispering gallery, we must maintain total silence. Even our breathing will be slightly audible. If a loud noise were to be made, all could be lost. The gallery, at its height, forms what appear to be tiny fissures in the mountain into which we are crossing. And near the opening of these fissures, there is a guard post. I placed one there years ago. I realized the tunnels were a potential route for an enemy, but I did not elect to have the tunnels sealed, perhaps envisioning in the future some use such as we indeed make now of the tunnels. So posting a sentry station there was the logical answer. They would hear us clearly if anything were said above the sound of the softest whisper. I give no contingency plans in that event, but I would assume that they would begin firing through the vents and downward. It would be possible with the hard rock surface that bullets would ricochet and strike us. The noise of gunfire would most certainly deafen us, and perhaps cause rock slides, which would indeed kill us by hurtling us off the path into the abyss.
I can see why these caverns never became a tourist attraction.
Quite so, yes. I suggest that we rest here for a few more minutes before pressing on with our journey. Once we are through the Whispering Gallery, the path is wide and level, and it is less than a mile by your reckoning to the entrance into the complex.
Rourke shifted off the slings for the two M16s as he sat in the darkness. A woman's hand moved along his thigh and felt for his left hand. He closed his hand over it, but he could not be certain if the hand were that of Natalia or that of his wife.
Tell me, Herr Rubenstein, this penchant for being hit on the head, how much have you dealt with it over the years?
Paul Rubenstein tried to sit up. Dr. Munchen was smiling.
What the...
Lie still, my young friend. Although your surgery seems unaffected, and if anything heals marvelously well, you need to rest after this latest hit on the head.
He didn't hit me.
Ah!
Oh, yeah, he did. That Blackburn, where?
Paul pushed Munchin's hand away and sat up.
Where the hell...
Ah, shit!
He touched at his head where his own pistol had crashed down against it. He remembered it all now.
Annie! Where's Annie?
The battle, it goes on. Standartenfuhrer Mann's troops, who were left here with the Eden Project, fight to repel the forces under Hauptsturmfuhrer Sturm. The idea of fighting our comrades, it's very difficult. But I realized that you and Fräulein Rourke were nowhere about.
He smiled, but the smile was somehow a grim smile that conveyed no happiness.
Unfortunately...
Unfortunately what?
Rubinstein tried to stand, but Munchin placed his hands firmly on Paul's shoulders. Paul sagged back against the bulkhead.
One of the Soviet helicopters. It is missing. After I found you unconscious, I theorized that Fräulein Rourke's efforts had perhaps flushed to light.
What?
The Fräulein, I believe she was kidnapped by the Russian agent who murdered the unfortunate Fräulein Stankiewicz.
Paul rose to his feet, with Munchin helping him this time. Paul swayed with a sudden dizziness and sagged once more toward the bulkhead as Munchin tried to support him. He thought of the irony of it that a man in a Nazi uniform should be helping him, a Jew, and he realized for the first time that John Rourke had been right. These Germans, men who wore the wrong uniform, were trying to change that. Rubinstein looked Munchin squarely in his bright blue eyes.
Doctor, it was Forrest Blackburn. And if he stole a chopper, it means he abandoned his idea of killing Dodd and taken over as leader of the Eden Project.
Rubinstein shook his head. It hurt. He realized he wasn't talking straight, realized it from the puzzled look in Munchin's eyes.
Did any of you...
He sagged back against the bulkhead, slipping to his knees. Munchin guided him carefully down.
Hey, Rubinstein, you must rest.
No. Don't you see? Blackburn. He's the Russian agent. He's got Annie. He's gonna kill her, but... Okay, follow me if I make sense. He was gonna kill us both. Blame some of your people. It was just when the attack began. My pistol, he had my pistol. A 9mm, like some of your officers still carry. He was gonna kill us and blame your people and then kill Dodd and take over to lead the Eden Project. But here, if he stole a chopper, then something went wrong. If... Maybe Annie's still alive with him.
I am sure that Fräulein Rourke is still alive, Herr Rubinstein. Dr. Hickson and I, we tended to the wounded, dragging some of them nearer to the road surface and away from the heaviest concentrations of fighting. I witnessed as the Soviet helicopter rose into the air. There was no one shooting at it. It circled and traveled toward the north. I came looking for you, and outside the shuttlecraft found Jane Harwood. She was shot in the chest. I tended to her wounds, progressed inside, and I found you.
Then Jane Harwood must have come looking for us when the shooting started, and he gunned her down.
But she will live, Herr Rubinstein. A medical technician who accompanied me attends her even now.
Is she...
Yes, conscious, yes. Come, can you stand again if I help you?
Paul stood with Munchin's help. He walked beside Munchin, leaning heavily on the German doctor for support.
How's it?
The battle goes on, I think, Herr Rubinstein. Hauptsturmfuhrer Sturm is a loyal Nazi. What he lacks in manpower and weapons, he makes up in anger, I think. A battle rages at the Standartenfuhrer's camp, and the battle rages here. I think that Hauptsturmfuhrer Sturm must lose. But there are casualties among the Eden personnel and among those loyal to Standartenfuhrer Mann.
As they stepped out of the shuttle, the sunlight and cold shocked Rubinstein into heightened consciousness. Paul saw something gleaming in the dirt.
That! Get it! I'm all right.
Rubinstein leaned against the hatch frame. Munchin looked once at him, then dashed down to the ground level. Paul Rubinstein watched as the German doctor picked up the object.
A pistol of some sort, Herr Rubinstein.
Annie's. Annie's Derringer.
He started down the steps, almost fell, and caught himself as Munchen hurried back to help him down the rest of the steps. He sank to his knees at the side of Jane Harwood as a female medical technician applied a bandage of some sort to Harwood's left shoulder, just above the Eden III captain's breast. Rubinstein balanced his upper body against his thighs with his hands for support. He was growing faint, but he would not allow himself to pass out.
Captain Harwood, did you see Annie walk? Please.
Rubinstein took the American Derringer from Dr. Munchen. He worked the lever over the spur trigger to break the action, rotating the barrels upward. Both rounds in place, neither of the primers struck.
Shit!
He closed the pistol, lowering the hammer to the safety notch, and pocketed it.
Captain Harwood, answer me. Please, dear God, answer me.
Annie. Forrest Blackburn. She...
Is she alive?
Yes.
Jane Harwood's head sank back onto an inflatable pillow. She had a pretty face with pale skin, dark brown hair, and green eyes.
She has passed out, Herr Rubinstein.
Munchen was on his knees beside the injured Eden III captain.
Herr Rubinstein, she will not be able to continue your conversation for some time, I think. She shall need quite a bit of attention and...
What the hell's going on?
Rubinstein looked up to see Captain Dodd.
Captain, Forrest Blackburn stole a chopper, took Annie. He's the communist agent. We gotta go after him.
Paul could barely hold up his head.
We gotta do a lot of things, Mr. Rubinstein. Like win this battle for openers. What the...
Dodd dropped to his knees beside Jane Harwood, setting down his M16.
I heard that Jane Harwood had been shot. Is she...
She shall recover, I think, Herr Captain. You had best listen to Herr Rubinstein. What he has to say could affect us all.
Dodd looked over his shoulder.
If you're so concerned about Miss Rourke, well, remember, if she...
Shut the fuck up!
You...
No! Annie! She's flushed him out, and now Blackburn's got her, and if Captain Harwood hadn't seen him, Blackburn was gonna kill her. Annie! Gonna kill me! Gonna kill you, for Christ's sakes!
Rubinstein raised up, his neck aching with the pain in his head.
I want help in getting after Blackburn.
This Blackburn, he evidently stole one of the Soviet gunships.
Couldn't get more than 100 miles in it if he did. Then what's he going to use for gas, huh? North of where St. Louis used to be is mostly ice.
Dodd turned to Paul Rubinstein.
I'm sorry about Miss Rourke. I guess I owe all of your family an apology, Mr. Rubinstein. Major Chermarovna, most of all, maybe. But we got a battle to win. Got dead to bury, got defenses to prepare. I can't spare a pilot or one of the few helicopters we've got or any fuel for it. The survival of the rest of the Eden Project could mean the survival of civilization, of democracy. Especially if Dr. Rourke's mission with Colonel Mann fails. Once we're done here, we're getting to one of the underground supply caches and getting fortifications built. We can have the rest of the Germans, the Russians, everybody down on us. No. I'm sorry about Miss Rourke, Mr. Rubinstein, but I can't spare anyone to go after her.
Paul Rubinstein pushed himself up to a standing position.
You son of a...
Paul fell over and closed his eyes. They were entering the Whispering Gallery. Rourke heard footfalls on the rock ledge, the sound of small rocks cascading from the surface of the narrow ledge into the blackness below. And like a dull growl in the blackness, the stream crashed along below them out of sight, concealed in the darkness. In a cone of yellow light, he could see Natalia's feet as she edged along just ahead of Sarah. He moved on, both rifles slung at his right side and lashed together so they would not bang against one another and issue a betraying sound. His musette bag and his canteen hung at his right side. He used the musette bag as a buffer between the rifles and the canteen. He could hear Wolfgang Mann's footfalls loudest of all because Mann, as the trailblazer, encountered the largest number of loose rocks, silt, and sediment. They kept moving. Natalia's lantern swung up, and for an instant he could see fear in Natalia's eyes. Then he saw Sarah's hair and face. He saw the same determination in her face he saw since reuniting with her before the fires consumed the air. It was a strength he had never seen in the time they spent together before the night of the war. The lantern swung away, and he could see only their feet, his feet, and the progressively narrowing ledge. Rourke could feel more than see that they were edging steadily upward at what, at least for now, seemed a gentle angle. His right foot slipped, and he splayed his arms against the wall that backed the ledge. His left knee buckled slightly before he caught his weight. He caught his breath, regained the proper footing, and moved on. The angle of the ledge became steadily steeper and narrowed. Shafts of yellow light, but paler than the yellow light of the lanterns, filtered down through clouds of airborne dust as he looked ahead, the light still too distant to illuminate the path. As they moved forward and upward, Rourke could see the origins of the light, the fissures Wolfgang Mann spoke of, through which the sentries posted above could hear them. John Rourke no longer walked the ledge, but rather edged forward a few inches at a time, his guns and gear hanging like a pendulum from the front of his body. It threw his balance slightly off, but there was no other way to traverse the ledge. Rourke watched as Wolfgang Mann passed through the nearest of the downward-ranging shafts of light. It was then that Sergeant Hines slipped from the ledge and fell away to be lost in the darkness. In the arc of Mann's lamp, Rourke could see Natalia stooping over the abyss, swinging her lantern downward. The noise of Heinz's fall, followed by the sentry's rifle fire, vibrated through Rourke's entire being. As he edged forward along the ledge, Rourke could see Sarah ahead, her hands clasped to her ears, her mouth open in a soundless scream as Mann swung his lantern upward. Natalia was on her knees along the ledge, her mouth open wide as well, her left hand purchased precariously against the wall of rock behind her, her right arm swinging the lantern down into the darkness. Mann, too, was on his knees, his lantern swinging down into the darkness. Rourke touched a hand to his wife's shoulder, drawing her back against the rock wall, gesturing with his other hand in the shaft of yellow light, which now cast a pale glow around them. Sarah understood and flattened herself against the rock wall. Rourke edged around her from the portion of ledge where he was standing to a narrow spot just beyond her, his hands clawing for a purchase against the rock surface, her left hand on his right wrist, his left foot swinging into the abyss. But he had the ledge. He edged slightly forward. He could barely hear over the hollow wailing sound that filled his ears. Another few minutes, and he and the others would suffer permanent hearing damage. A few minutes more, and it might be permanent hearing loss. A spray of rock chips pelted his face. Rourke's eyes, already squinted, shut tight against it. He opened his eyes into narrow slits and edged ahead. He was beside Natalia now, staring down into the abyss where Mann's and Natalia's lantern shone, scanning the fringe of light and darkness for some sign of Sergeant Hines. Then Rourke saw it. He squinted shut against it for an instant, against the comparative brightness. As he peered down again, the light shone again, and Rourke averted his eyes. It was Hines, still alive and signaling with his powerful battery-operated handheld searchlight. Rourke looked to Wolfgang Mann. The climbing rope hung about Mann's torso. Rourke thought bitterly they should have lashed themselves together and perhaps saved Hines. But it might also have meant that when Hines fell, he would have pulled the rest of them after him and off the ledge. Rourke gestured to Mann. Mann nodded. The German colonel slipped the coiled climbing rope from his frame and handed it to Rourke. Rourke found the plastic sealed end and shook out several feet of the rope, passing it back to Mann. Mann wound the rope into a harness behind his shoulders, bound it over his chest, and tied it off. Rourke began uncoiling the remaining portion of the rope after first passing the coil behind Natalia. She understood his intent as well, standing to her full height, securing a loop into a knot with the rope, anchoring herself to it as well. Rourke shook the remainder of the rope down into the darkness. The light flashed, evidently in some sort of signal code Rourke could not comprehend. Three long flashes, two short, then a long and a short. Rourke looked to Wolfgang Mann. Mann stabbed his left forefinger downward toward the flashing light of Sergeant Hines. Then Mann shook his head. Rourke tugged at the rope. Either Hines had it, or it was caught on a rock. It would not budge. He looked again to Wolfgang Mann, but they couldn't speak. Rourke squinted again as another spray of rock chips and dust pelted his face. Mann gestured downward with his left index finger. Natalia started to untie her rope. Rourke grabbed at her hands, then tugged at the hitch in the rope, bound around her shoulders and chest. Rourke passed his assault rifles beyond Natalia and into Sarah's hands. Sarah slung them crossbody beside her own weapons. The musette bag and the canteen Rourke passed to Wolfgang Mann. Rourke's fists closed over the rope. He gestured to Natalia, then to Mann. He was going down. He found his blood-stained gloves and pulled them on. His ears pained him now. Rourke swallowed, keeping his mouth open. Nothing seemed to ease it. He started downward, holding to the rope, rappelling, his feet against the rock surface beneath the ledge, his hands locked to the rope. Rourke looked below him. The searchlight flashed again. He kept moving downward, his feet dislodging rocks, his body swinging outward and then slamming against the rock face. He swung, the pendulum motion momentarily bringing on a wave of nausea. He swung his feet right and left, at last finding a purchase, kicking against it to be certain that it was steady. The light flashed again. Rourke started downward once more. It was no longer conscious will, but instinct that drove him toward the light. He kept shifting downward, ever nearer to the light. Downward. The roaring in his ears unceasing now, a steadily growing cacophony in his head. They were shooting downward through the fissures, Rourke knew, because as he moved along the rock surface, he could feel sprays of rock and dust pelting his face, his neck, and the exposed skin at his wrists between his gloves and his shirt sleeves. The lantern light seemed impossibly bright now. He averted his eyes, but kept moving to it. He could feel the rope biting through his gloves, but he kept moving to the light. Rourke pressed his feet against a wide ledge, straightening his legs, locking his knees. His body hung outward. He edged along the ledge now, flattening his body against the rock surface, reaching out with his left hand toward the light. Rourke's right hand tightened on the rope. His left hand closed over the face of the searchlight. John Rourke tugged at the light. He felt Hines tug back. Rourke edged further out along the ledge. In the glow of the light, he saw that he was on a narrow peninsula of rock, surrounded on three sides by the abyss. He sank to his knees, crawling forward, his right hand locked to the rope, his left hand groping into the darkness so he would not suddenly fall because he could not see the far edge. He sagged forward against something that gave slightly at his touch. It was Sergeant Hines. John Rourke grabbed again at the searchlight, twisted it free, and turned it around. Hines' left temple dripped blood, and his right arm was twisted at the elbow, almost back against itself. Hines' eyes seemed clear. The German sergeant attempted a smile, then gestured with his left hand down along the length of his body. Rourke watched the man's eyes and followed the direction of Sergeant Hines' gaze with the searchlight to the soldier's left leg. It seemed a simple fracture at first glance. Rourke reached to his belt, drew the long-bladed Gerber MK2 from its sheath, and inserted the blade at Hines' pulled-up trouser cuff, which he simultaneously drew up from inside the jackboot. The jackboots were made of a synthetic that looked and felt like leather. Rourke began working the blade along the trouser seam of Hines' BDU pants. There was no redness visible as he laid back the material to study the skin. The fracture had not penetrated the skin. He shone the light back toward Hines' face. Hines was out. Rourke checked for pulse and breathing. Hines had simply passed out and seemed in no immediate danger. There was no chance of doing anything substantial with the leg, not until they reached safety. Rourke, as gently as he could, unslung the two assault rifles Hines carried. He removed their magazines and quickly inspected the weapons themselves to learn the method of disassembly. The completely assembled rifles would be too heavy and awkward to use as splints, but the plastic stocks would be ideal. He found what looked like a dismount latch, but worked the actions first to check that no round was chambered in either weapon. Then he turned the dismount latch. For a rifle, it was surprisingly like a pistol, using the basic system pioneered in the Walther P-38, but the dismount latch served to release the bolt carrier. He lifted this away. Beneath a trigger guard housing, at the very front of the guard, he found a knurled piece. Rourke tugged at this. The trigger housing group fell out with only slight pressure. John Rourke shook his head. The assembly was simple, but not so sturdy an arrangement as to be found with Colt, Ruger, or earlier rifles. He found another latch, recessed beneath the front handguard and inset. It latched downward under finger pressure. The barrel and receiver freed themselves from the one-piece stock. He threw the metal parts aside, no longer concerned about noise. He reached up to the sergeant's waist, undoing the brown web belt threaded through the man's trouser loops. Positioning one of the plastic stocks on either side of the shin, the belt beside the nearer one, Rourke grasped the leg. As he pulled, he pressed firmly, setting the bone. He felt Hines' body twitch. Rourke positioned the impromptu splint and bound it to the leg with the belt. He moved the light, shifting along on his knees to the upper body. Gingerly, he touched at the twisted and misshapen arm. It was a dislocated shoulder, no apparent damage to the elbow. Rourke checked Heinz's breathing. Even. The German sergeant's unconsciousness would make it easier. He felt at the shoulder, grasping the arm firmly, drawing it out straight. He began to work the arm in a circular motion, twisting it through the gap between the muscles. He could feel the pop. Gently, he rested the forearm across Heinz's chest, bending the arm slowly at the elbow. Rourke bent across Heinz and cut away the left BDU sleeve at the seam where it mated with the shoulder. He wrenched the sleeve down along the left arm and, using the Gerber again, sliced it open along the seam. He halved the sleeve. Rourke sheathed the knife, closing the scabbard retainer to secure it. He tied the two sections of sleeve fabric together. He gauged the length, more than adequate. Sliding the tail of the material under Heinz at the small of the back, Rourke worked it up along the torso until it was in position, secured the arm just below the elbow, then bound both sections of the sleeve together with a simple square knot, securing the arm tightly enough to the chest that it wouldn't slip down. He began to fashion a cradle out of the climbing rope around the unconscious German's body, avoiding the dislocated shoulder, securing the right leg to the injured left leg for added firmness. Trussed securely, Rourke dragged Heinz back along the spit of rock. After quickly examining for neck or back injury, he found no evidence of either. The head wound seemed superficial, the bleeding already stopped. Rourke secured the light to his own belt and shut it off as he tugged solidly on the rope. There was an answering tug. Then he guided Heinz's body toward the rock face, shining the light on it as soon as his hands were free. Heinz rose upward. He still could not hear, and as he turned away from the light, all he could see was the blackness of the abyss. According to the luminous black face of Rourke's Rolex Submariner, it took 12 minutes for Heinz to make the journey upward, the rope to be undone and dropped back toward the spit of rock, and then Rourke to rappel back to the ledge. Rourke secured Heinz's arm more sturdily, and the group continued moving along the ledge. First Wolfgang Mann. Then after 15 minutes, John Rourke took the still unconscious young soldier over their shoulders in a modified fireman's carry. The ledge was too narrow for him to be carried any other way. After what Rourke judged as perhaps an hour, he could tell the effect of the gunfire's amplified sound in the whispering gallery was at least slightly diminished. The shooting had stopped, but he could not tell when. He figured it as 10 minutes since they left the pale yellow light of the last vent and returned to the total darkness of the abyss. The darkness broken only by the cones of light from Natalia, Sarah, and Mann's lanterns. Beyond the effective range of the lanterns, the darkness was total, or seemed so. They kept moving.